Welcome, lucky listeners. Grab yourselves a hot cup of... Tuck yourself down deep into the covers and make sure the lights are on. It's time for Read Me a Nightmare.
Welcome to episode 37 of Read Me a Nightmare. I'm Angelique Fons, your host, and today we have a fun episode for you. Pete Leed, a fellow author, advisor to startups, and improv actor, presents his own story, A Review of Bondi Beach, written by Henry the Shark. Pete Leed is a writer, narrator, and facilitator who currently calls New Zealand his home. You can learn more about him at www.peteleed.com. Stay tuned after the reading for a conversation about looking at writing as a business plus strategies for success. Let's get into the story.
A Review of Bondi Beach, written by Henry the Shark. Written and read by Pete Leed. Bondi Beach sits in the middle of a coastal strip known as the Golden Sands. The water is warm and regular currents flow from the north and south to get you there easily, though perhaps making it too easy to skip some of the less popular spots nearby. Bondi is famous for its varied wildlife, which come out in schools from November to March, though some of the more daring shallow swimmers can see them year-round. With so much going on, there is one simple rule. Don't eat the wildlife. Every so often some idiot thinks he's above the rules and the debate rages on again on talkback radio. No, 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 delete, delete. Worth the hype if you don't mind the crowds. A great place to visit with friends or a loved one. Not much fun for a lone shark. Three starfish. Henry stopped, rubbed his nose on the sand. What am I doing? He thought. The Swimmy Morning Herald, SMH as it was now branded, might not have standards anymore, but I do. Well, he liked to think he did. Henry sighed, bubbles tickling his stomach as they bounced up his body on their journey to the surface. Online publishing forced his deadlines shorter and his headlines grabbier. Quality of copy was no longer a priority. In fact, he was pretty sure nobody even read his work before it was published for all to see. All his editor Derek seemed to care about was traffic. "Sea folk don't read the news cover to cover anymore," spouted Derek in their monthly strategy breaches. "They skim, they flow, they follow catchy buzzwords like a worm on a hook. One weird trick for a streamlined physique. The freshwater diet. Kelp exfoliants. That kind of thing. Click, 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 like a fucking orca sounding out a baby seal to play ball with." "But what happened to good old-fashioned journalism?" Henry wanted to know. "Writing something worth reading." "Go with the current," Derek liked to say. "If you stop moving forward, then you die." Henry knew the net would be the death of him, or at least the happy part of him that used to swim free, soaking up sun rays and bullying dolphins. That part didn't stop moving forward. It left him behind right about the time he told Margaret he needed to focus on his career. He wondered if Margaret was still happy. She was always so buoyant, surely nothing would have brought her down. His cartilage ached. He too often spent his days stooped over a keyboard, not enough time enjoying life. One day he'd go dorsal, swim into a post office and eat a bunch of innocent crustaceans. That would make news, he thought, but given the state of things, they'd probably spell his name wrong. Delete, delete, delete. "The best part of Bondi," he typed, "is the wildlife. Skirt around the heritage-listed safety nets and you can hunker down in the shallows and watch them parade right past your snout. The smells are irresistible." And why resist? There are so many different flavours on offer. The flesh varies from white to red to brown, each with its own signature characteristics. Bondi is a breeding ground, so no matter how many individuals go missing, they'll keep coming back to this spot. Year after year after year. The only thing you have to worry about is getting the material out from between your teeth. Bondi appetite. Henry felt electric, like he'd been chomping on eels. "And if you're reading this, Margaret," he added, "you were right. Of course you were. There are more important things in life. You should have been one of them." if it's not too late, well, if you still want to visit Fremantle, there's nothing holding me back now. His fin hovered over the submit button. To hell with it, he thought. And for the first time in years, Henry wore a smile that spread all the way to the back rows of his inward pointing teeth.
Okay, that was one of the cutest stories I've heard in a long time. I once visited Bondi Beach and I did see a few sharks in the water. Could one of them have been Henry? Anyway, let's jump into the interview. Hi, everybody. We're sitting here today with Pete Lead, and you've just listened to his story, A Review of Bondi Beach by Henry the Shark. Tell us about your inspiration for this story, Pete.
This was a story that I wrote about 10 years ago, maybe. And at the time, I was running what I called an open mic variety show. And so the idea was that I would get people come along and they could do anything they wanted. They had the stage for 10 minutes and they could do, stand-up comedy, read a story, read poetry. But, you know, we also had string quartets and barbershop quartets and magicians and all sorts of people come along. And we had various people propose different things for the show. And one of them was a writing challenge. And the challenge for this one, for this particular week, was someone has a deadline. And I think the other part of the challenge was a scene takes place underwater. And at the time, there'd been shark attacks around Australia. So there'd been a shark attack in Western Australia. I feel like there was one at Bondi Beach. And because of that, in the news, there had been all sorts of things around the shark protection that was around Australia. And I had never known that at Bondi Beach, there were drum lines or hook lines or something. And it's like, oh, that's really interesting that there are these things around our beaches and I've never thought about them.
What are they? I'm sorry. What is a hook line or what are they?
So I know drum. So these are things to protect the beach from sharks. I'm pretty sure drum lines are like long lines that are at the entrance to the beach, obviously the ocean side entrance to the beach, that attract the sharks and catch them. But they're bad because they catch other things as well, like, you know, dolphins, and there are nets that tortoises get caught in. But I'd never known that there were these things that were around the beaches. And I thought, well, I wonder if there's like TripAdvisor, but for the sharks. Like, do they give each other warnings that, hey, don't go to Bondi because you might get caught in the net that goes around? Started writing that story.
Oh, that's amazing. So how did you get into writing? I know your job is more on the technical side of things.
Yeah. My job at the moment is, or for the last 5 years, has been working with tech startup companies, which are people who are trying brand new things, coming up with new business models, new products, new ways of delivering a solution to a problem. And so I've only recently returned to writing fiction in the last 6 or 8 months. And that actually came from YouTube's algorithm just started, for some reason, serving me Brandon Sanderson's writing classes, the classes he runs for the university in, I want to say, Utah. And I was like, oh, this looks interesting. I read a lot. I'm curious about this. And that just rekindled the fire of telling stories. So my background is in university. So 25 years ago now, I started doing theater sports, which is improvised comedy. And that kind of kindled this love for performing and telling stories and, you know, making jokes. And through wanting to become a better improviser, I had to learn more about telling good stories. So, you know, we'd go and learn about the hero's journey and all of these different writing techniques or storytelling techniques that then led to me putting on shows. And, you know, one of the things was doing this variety show and having this writing challenge. And I was like, well, you know, I wanted to tell stories. So I used to tell you know, 12 stories a night, doing these improvised scenes, but let's try writing them down. And so this story and a few of the others that you have seen started as, I guess, monologues, so performance pieces to be read or to be performed on stage. And I was listening to, I think Clark's World podcast was around at that time. I know definitely Escape Pod was. And yeah, I just kind of kindled the idea of, well, I tell stories on stage, maybe I could tell a story on a podcast, and started submitting. I submitted an entirety of one story to one podcast, which was Escape Pod, back in 2013 or something like that. And I didn't realize until now, getting back into writing and learning how all of this stuff works, that what I actually got when I submitted to Escape Pod was as kind of a revise and resubmit. Like, it was a personalized rejection that was an invitation to, if I rewrite the story or write the ending to the story, I could resubmit it. And I just never did, which...
Oh, no, and it's Escape Pod, only one
I know.
Oh, wow, that hurts.
So, yeah, I know.
And somebody hasn't gotten one from them. I've never gotten a revise and resubmit from Escape Pod. Boy, I'd be dancing.
Uh-huh. So I should have been. I think young me was like, oh, they didn't accept my story. But yes, fair enough. This is a good suggestion. I should write this. But yeah.
Oh, we all make mistakes like that. That's hilariously sad, but also hilarious.
That is a very good definition.
Well, I know now you're in our Fireside Quills group. I've got a question for you. Actually, I've got two questions going on right now. One is, based on what you do, I'm surprised you didn't veer into script writing as opposed to pure story writing, because it sounds like with your improv background, script writing might have been a more natural progression for you.
That is a really good point. And one of the stories that I, or rather, yeah, it was a story that I performed as a monologue. I turned into, I guess, a script for a one-man play. But again, it was like, you know, you're young and you don't know what to do with it. So there was one short play, I guess, competition in Sydney that I submitted to, and it wasn't selected, and that kind of went by the wayside. That's a good point. I don't know why I never wrote. I think the reason is probably because writing stories is a solo pursuit, and putting a play on, I knew how much work that was, where it was like, you know, you've got to produce it and you've got to cast it and direct it and all that kind of stuff. Whereas you could just put something on it. Well, for me, it was like put something on a page and go and perform it that Wednesday night. And then it's already written down. So why not give it to Escape Pod? But yeah.
Isn't that interesting and true? I'm mainly asking because, as you know, anybody who follows me knows that I am determined to find the profitability, right? So I keep trying to explore how we can actually make a little bit of money at this, because it is work. There's no way writing's not work. In fact, it's, you know, neck, I won't say breaking, but it makes your neck sore, your back sore. It takes hours. It takes time out of doing other things. I mean, we're all obsessed with it, obviously, but it would be nice to also make some money. Mm. And with my interview with Robert J. Sawyer, he's like, well, script writing, it's $6 a word. And if you're lucky with writing short stories, it's 6 cents a word. But I think there's also far fewer places to submit them. And I, right now at this point, have no idea of what the markets are for script writing, but I'm intending to look. Next project, where do you sell scripts and how do you get your foot in that door?
Yeah, it's interesting. I like, all I know of, you know, Hollywood is how difficult it is to get anything made. Like, if you write a screenplay, the chances of that actually making it to the screen are really, really, really remote. Like, you've got pilot season if it's TV shows, or, you know, getting a director and a producer attached and getting something through the Hollywood studio system to actually get a movie made. It's like, well, you could be there for 10 years and not, you know, something like Princess Bride that took 10 or 15 years to get made and nearly, you know, didn't. So I probably knew more about that than I knew about the publishing industry. And this is, you know, when I was younger and was like, what do I want to be? I would love to write a Hollywood movie. That was probably a dream before writing a novel was a dream. It's interesting that I didn't go. All I can think of is, like, I knew that that was hard, and I didn't know that writing fiction for print was not hard. Because you kind of see, like, oh, a best-selling novelist, and you just assume they've got it made, and now they spend their days, you know, typing at a typewriter and writing these hip novels. It's not quite like that.
I don't think it is. I don't think it is. I think, you know, as they say, what is the average author makes 10,000 a year? Hmm. I mean, and then of course there's the outliers. We've got our Stephen Kings and our, you know, Stephanie Ivankovich's and our, there's the outliers. But there is a world out there if you can get into it. It's just how do we, you and I, Pete, and our friends and our Fireside Quills and the Wolf Pack get into being profitable writers. So it's very challenging, not a viable income. You need the day job. So I've been talking to Mark Leslie. I'm going to try and launch some short story collections, but I found with the three books I launched before, they sell a little bit, maybe 500 in total. But once again, if you sell them at 99 cents and you get 33 cents per copy, it's still not shaking us out to anything at all. So
yeah, it's interesting. So putting my, you know, like startup advisor hat on.
Oh, here we go. I love this. Here we go.
Yeah. So thinking about, so I always look at, there's a distinction that I like to make between users and customers, right? So users are people who use the product. So if you think about Facebook or something, you know, there's someone who creates an account and puts their opinions up on the wall. They're the users, and customers are the people who are paying you, right? So in Facebook's case, that would be advertisers, brands who want to put ads up there. They're the customers. The individuals are the users. And when you think about it from a, let's say, a short fiction magazine, like a Clark's World or something, their customers are the readers who subscribe, I guess, you know, pay the $25 a year or whatever, or potentially, I haven't looked at Clark's World in particular, but, you know, or potentially advertisers, so people who have ads on the page or ads in the print magazine. And the people who write the stories, the us's, I guess we're like suppliers, right? Like they buy 12 stories, they put them together into a product that they can then sell to customers. And so for us as authors, our customer in that instance is the magazine. The challenge, the bit that's not scalable, is that we can sell one story maybe once every year. Like you sell first rights and then you could sell reprint a year later, maybe later. So each story you can sell once to one customer, you know, once per year. The magazine can sell it as many times as they want because it's a product. So at the moment, there are fewer readers than there used to be and more writers, I think, than there used to be.
That's true.
The problem, so, you know, thinking of from a startup lens, what's the problem that our customer has, so the magazines, the publications, the problem that they're facing is how do we make money? Like, how do we get back to profitability or sustainability and get more readers? They don't have the problem of we need more stories because there are a lot of them. I think if you were to try and look at it from the author side, what is a problem that we could solve for these publications? I think maybe newer publications, so they don't yet have the reputation, they might not be getting enough stories. It could be particular types of stories that they're not getting, you know, especially from underrepresented writers. You know, are there enough people from different cultural backgrounds, different lived experiences, but maybe even particular topics? So, you know, if we think about Dreamforge magazine or Solarpunk, like, they are looking for particular stories that, you know, they exist because those stories aren't out there as much. So perhaps they might, you know, they might have the problem of not having enough stories. But it's still hard. It's still selling one story to one publication.
No, you're right. And that's a problem. So really, you have to go to direct to consumer. That's what an author needs to do, because you don't want to sell just to one person. You want to sell to the masses, right? So you sort of, you need to find your own audience, which is then, of course, this is what I always liken it to, a million voices screaming in a void and nobody's hearing any of us, right? Because there's so many of us screaming.
We need the Harry Potter or the Iron Man movie for short stories. The thing that gets everyone going, ah, yes, I read that or I've seen that. And, you know, let's go make a million superhero movies. I want more superhero movies, or I want more books about wizards. We need that for 5,000 word stories.
Like Hugh Howie, or like his story is amazing. But you listen to some of the stuff he said in podcasts. And this is the underlying message I'm actually getting from absolutely everyone that I've interviewed, is that because the chance of outrageous success is so minuscule, even if you have all the talent in the world, there's so many other things that have to link, right? You have to have, you know, luck. You have to have the right people find you at the right amount of time. You have to hit, if you're online, it's like Hugh Howie and Amazon, whatever the algorithm was and whatever he was writing snowballed, right? But the message from everybody is because the chance is so minuscule, you have to have the passion and the love for just the creation. It has to be something you need to do like breathing, and you cannot expect profit from it. You have to do it, and despite the fact that you're probably not going to make money, which for me is a hard message to swallow because I don't like that. Because
well, the other way of doing it, which, you know, you're kind of doing, is kind of having the portfolio approach of maybe you've got some stories that you sell to, you know, traditional publishers, some things that you you know, sell direct to consumer. Maybe you run workshops, or, you know, like you've got a podcast, like, you know, can you be advertiser supported? So lots of different revenue streams. I mean, even the big authors are doing workshops or teaching at university or using the, and it's almost a loss leader. Like, you sell a story for $500 to a magazine, but that gets your name out there, which then you can on sell to that that reader, a workshop or a, you know, screenplay.
That's true. So that's Joanna Penn, Mark Leslie. They're all, the multiple streams of income is the only way to get things done. So of course, you know, if somebody tells me this is how you do it, I will try it, because what else am I doing? I'm sitting here for hours anyway, right? But it's interesting how long it takes. Everything is taking longer than I thought it would. The newsletter, because I have the newsletter and the podcast, and I write the short stories, and I write for a variety. I just don't write for speculative. The truth be known, most of my sales this year, Pete, have been to either nonfiction markets or, for example, I sold a short story that I had forever. It's one of those ones you write and you're sure it's great, but nobody else agrees with you. I finally sold it to Transitions, which is a mental health magazine for the Canadian Mental Health Institute in Saskatchewan. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure it's Saskatchewan. I hope I'm not wrong. And, you know, it was a good pay for what I wrote, pro pay. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. So like what you're saying is, like, where is there the need for material? And mental health is a burgeoning sort of... there's a lot of awareness going on. There's a lot of talk about it, and there's probably some need for content. I guess you're right. You got to sort of zone in on where are the less traditional places looking, because you can read a great story about a dwarf in a pub, right? The trope, but nobody, there's so many of those out there. They're almost impossible to sell, I think. Right. And there's so few magazines that are looking for that kind of thing, or if they do, they're getting hundreds and hundreds a month. So
I think it's interesting, you know, like looking at what people are not writing that editors may be more likely to buy.
Oh my God, that's genius. What are people not writing? That's right. That's really where we have to focus. And then once again, scalability, right? I mean, I sort of love the idea of shared world for a group like ours, like a shared world thing where we can create something that's so interesting that people just can't help but read it. I always think of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or something like that, like something that's just so out there that you can't help but have to read it. And then it becomes iconic, right? It's interesting.
Yeah, it's when you talk about, so just drawing back on startup world metaphors for writing, you talked about, you know, the chance of success is so small, getting a story, getting a particular author or a particular work becoming that massive success. In venture capital, there's a thing called the power law, where unlike a bell curve where, you know, you've got like a few that are very successful, the middle is, most people at the middle and then a few kind of at the tail end. The power law is that, you know, one or two successes will give you 90% of your return. And so that's why venture capital, they invest in portfolios. They might give $1 million each to 100 companies, knowing that one company might return $100 million and the others might return either nothing or just, you know, like their money back or double their money. And it feels kind of like that when you say that, like, you know, there's going to be one Stephen King for the, you know, thousand of the rest of us. In that scenario, you'd be better off being the agent where you can represent 100 authors knowing that one or two of them might become Stephen King, and then you get a big paycheck.
Isn't that interesting? It's true. It is true. Well, what I'm going to be interested in is doing a part two with you in a year or two and seeing if we've learned or grown our careers any. That's what I think will be very interesting. Like, what's next for Pete? What are you doing to grow your author career?
I'm probably going more with that portfolio approach. With my improv background and my coaching background, like I'm very good at coaching. I'm very good at running classes and workshops. And so I've been looking at, you know, adapting what I know from improvising, running workshops on improvisation for creative writing, because I think that, you know, I want to explore what I can introduce from that world that is already being covered by 100 other authors, you know, running 100 other workshops on hero's journey and depth and character. I'd love to do that. I mean, I've been really interested in doing the critiquing and editing. So I feel like, you know, my author career will be a bit of everything. I mean, I'm a professional generalist anyway, so I don't.
You're a jack of all trades. That's wild. Well, this has been a great conversation, Pete. I've enjoyed talking to you immensely, and you've given me a new outlook on this business, which is, you know, what I'm looking for with this podcast and for my listeners. Okay, well, thank you. Tell people where they can find you.
They can find me at my brand new author website, petelead.com, where you can see the story that is going to be my first sale, which I sold to The Dread Machine. You can learn about the audio narration that I've been doing, and you can join my mailing list and learn when I'll be doing these improvisation for creative writing workshops.
Woo, that's what we're really interested in. This workshop world is very interesting, because I've been finding my mind's been blown with the ones I've been taking. I haven't taken one yet. I've taken some of Wolf Moons. I've taken some from Apex. Dreamforge has their visitors in. I found them all really, and I've taken some with Scott Knoll, who's amazing. And they all sort of have really helped me with my craft, because I know I can see a big difference in the writing I was doing when I started and the writing I'm doing now. And it's, you know, been based on the workshops. So people definitely check out Pete's workshops. I know I'm going to, as soon as I get a life back. Well, I sure learned a few things today. I loved that interview with Pete Lead. Once again, check him out at www.petelead.com. So thank you for hanging into the very end. And remember, sleep with your lights on till the next episode of Read Me a Nightmare.